Good morning. I'm Todd Gleason, setting in for David Inge, the host of Focus 580 this morning. We're joined in studio today by Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She's an OBGYN with a women's health practice here in Champaign-Urbana and a clinical professor at the College of Medicine here at the U of I. Good morning to you. Thanks for sitting in. This is our monthly discussion. Glad to have you on board today.
Thank you. Good morning.
What should we talk about to begin with? I thought we might start with fertility issues, but we could run the gamut of whatever our listeners are wanting to talk about this morning.
I thought that'd be a good idea as well.
All right. We'll give the phone numbers out. And if you have something you'd like to discuss with Dr. Truppen, please give us a call. The number toll-free is 1-800-222-9455. If you're in the local area, listening on the net anywhere around the globe, you can call us at 217-333-9455. Again, that's 800-222-9455 or 217-333-9455. A couple of things that you and I discussed before we went on the air. You've been talking about a vaccine for a while on the air, I believe, with David. And
yes.
It's been given a name. Is this correct?
Yes, and it's called Gardasil. It's G-A-R-D-A-S-I-L. And it is the vaccine that is hoping to prevent cervical cancer, abnormal pap smears, and genital warts. And I did notice on the internet over the weekend that there were some news reports about its effectiveness. And I thought some of the listeners would want to know if this is, in fact, the vaccine I'd been talking about and involved with. And we have some local patients involved with the clinical trials, and indeed it is.
And can you tell us about the effectiveness?
Well, we are still involved in the actual trials, and we're not sure. We think that the HPV virus 16 and 18 are responsible for somewhere between 75 and 80% of cervical cancer cases worldwide. And we think HPV viruses 6 and 11 are responsible for somewhere between 50 and 75% of all abnormal pap smears and all genital warts. And so if you design a vaccine targeting those specific HPV vaccines, it can be somewhere between 50 and 80% effective against those very serious conditions. And it's very exciting. And a number of trials are ongoing with both adolescents, young adults, and slightly older adults. So we have trials going on for people ages 10 to 45.
We do have a phone call already, a couple
okay.
of them. So we'll
Good.
Get straight to the way to the phones this morning. We have a caller on line one. Thanks for calling in. You have a question for Dr. Truppen this morning?
Yes, but as a matter of fact, I wanted to ask about what she was just talking about in addition to my original question.
Sure.
HPV virus, is that what it's called?
Yes, the human papilloma virus.
Oh, is that the same as herpes?
No. The herpes virus is nicknamed HSV.
Oh, okay.
So herpes simplex virus, and mostly when you talk about the herpes virus, you talk about type 1 and type 2. So
right,
HSV1
right.
or HSV2.
I see. Okay, well, my question was totally unrelated to this. It has to do with taking prenatal vitamins. When I first became pregnant about 2 years ago or almost 3 years ago, I was living in Japan. And I was very concerned that my OB did not prescribe prenatal vitamins. In fact, they don't exist there. And I was all upset and afraid and concerned, and I even called a hospital that catered to international patients and Americans and so on and spoke to, it was still a Japanese doctor, but he spoke English. And I said, well, don't I need prenatal vitamins? And he said, no. And I said, well, what about folic acid, you know, and spina bifida? And he said, the rate of spina bifida is so low. And he said, if you just eat a balanced diet, then you get, you know, don't worry about it. And the Japanese, of course, are very proud of their diet, even though it's changing rapidly to be more like ours. So I was just wondering if you could comment about that, please.
Okay. Well, you bring up a number of great points. And number one, the rates of certain birth defects are different in different cultures. Mm-hmm. And that may or may not be related to a genetic phenomena or a dietary phenomena in a mm-hmm. case like this. Number two, there is good research that you need a certain level of folic acid to prevent a neural tube defect. And actually, even with that, we don't prevent them all. But in our population, open neural tube defects are something like 1 in 1,000, which is very low. So, you know, if you thought 1 in 1,000 was low, maybe, you know, that, again, that's a statistic. Is that a high number or a low number? In the United States, we think it's a high number. We don't want to even see the 1 in 1,000. Mm-hmm. But you do need a certain amount of folic acid. And secondly, are you going to get that from a supplement or a diet? And it is true that probably if you crafted the perfect diet, that you could get all the nutrients that you need. We, many of us advocate prenatal supplementation with some of the omega fatty acids, the essential fatty acids, DHA and EHA, and we supplement with that. But again, Japanese tend to have a lot of fish. But yeah, with us, we have limits on how much fish that we allow our pregnant patients to take because of mercury levels in fish. And this may
ignore.
Yeah. And this may be something that will catch up to the Japanese society as well. And in our culture, at our activity level, the numbers of calories that you would have to consume to get some of these nutrients would probably be more. You'd probably end up gaining more than you would want to gain. So there is some balance to that. There's also a whole litany of theory about how much iron you really should have or shouldn't have. And it is possible to oversupplement. And so what he was saying was correct for their population, and yet virtually all of us do recommend supplementation in the United States. There's also, since then, in the past couple of years, been a couple of good studies looking at just multivitamin supplementation. So more than just the folic acid, looking at some of the other vitamins and showing a reduced incidence of birth defects of other kinds with vitamin supplementation. And so we all pretty much do believe in it. But if you had the perfect Japanese diet, you could probably have the perfectly healthy pregnancy without a supplement.
Hmm. Well, can I ask another question?
Sure. One more.
Thanks. Sorry. A friend of mine told me that her OB told her to wean her baby when she got pregnant because the breastfeeding could cause contractions of the uterus and result in a miscarriage. And my understanding was that those kinds of contractions only happen shortly after childbirth. And it caused her to wean her child before she really wanted to.
Well, a couple of things. Most women, when they're lactating, will continue to lactate in early pregnancy, but then the estrogen levels go up. Usually you stop producing very, very much actual food and nutrition.
Right.
Now, there is the suckling aspect, which can be very comforting for an infant, whether or not they're getting any food.
Yeah.
And we know that immediately after birth, we have these pulses of this hormone called oxytocin, and it's a pituitary hormone. The lactation hormone is actually prolactin. Mm. It's made by in the same area, and they might be supplementally, or I'm doing a word search here, but they may be secreted together in tandem some of the time, but if you measure a breastfeeding woman's prolactin level immediately after birth, it's very, very high.
Right.
If you measure a breastfeeding woman's prolactin level, say, a year or two out, it's very, very low.
Right.
You don't capture a high prolactin level, but if you do a study on her and put her in a research study, sure enough, during feeding, there are these pulses that shoot up.
Now, but enough to cause a miscarriage?
I do not think so.
Surely you feel that contraction.
Well, you don't necessarily feel all significant contractions, but I have never seen a research study showing increased rates of miscarriage or pregnancy loss secondary to lactation. Mm. That is something I could look up, but I do not recall seeing any studies of that nature. Yeah. And I do not usually recommend that my pregnant patients stop breastfeeding if they don't want to.
Yeah.
So I'm with you on that one, with the caveat that I'll look up in case there's some new research I don't know about.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. Bye.
We do have a caller that's been waiting online from Charleston this morning. Thank you. Appreciate you taking the time and waiting for us. Do you have a question for Dr. Troopin this morning?
Yes, I wondered how long it is useful to take medication for osteoporosis. I was diagnosed in the late 1990s and went on Fosamax and since shifted to Actonol. And I had a reading a couple years ago which showed a dip. My osteoporosis is complicated by scoliosis, and the reading was worse on the spine. And now I'm taking Myokalcin in the last 2 years and Forteo in the last year, and the reading hadn't improved in April from the one I had in 2002. And I'm also do weightlifting and take calcium and so forth. But I just wondered about being on Actonol, which I think has caused me some stomach problems so long, whether it's useful to be on it that long particularly, and why I wouldn't have a better reading after being on Forteo for a year.
Okay. First, we usually do remind our guests, I mean our listeners, that we can't diagnose over the phone. We can't give specific medical advice. And obviously, with the numbers of medications that you're on, your case is quite complicated. And usually in complicated cases, you may want to seek consultation with a specialist such as board-certified endocrinologist, for instance.
That's what I'm thinking of doing again.
Sure. So let me talk about the important topics that you do bring up. So first of all, the first thing is, what is osteoporosis? And osteoporosis is a skeletal disorder characterized by both a low bone density and a tendency to fracture, both those things. We think that the goal of all osteoporosis treatment is to prevent fracture. And this gets very complicated with both the young and the old, because when you're young, you're not very likely to fracture regardless what your numbers are. And when you're old, you are, you know, much older. And that varies from person to person. But let's talk about the people from, say, 80 to 100. And when we're older, we're much more likely to fracture for other reasons. We don't have as much body mass around our bones. We fall more often. We have other medical conditions that make us losing bones, calcium from our bones. In between, and, you know, I could probably give a couple of days seminar on all these issues, so I'm trying to be succinct and hopefully still clear. But we think that your tendency to fracture is due to two things, the thickness of your bone and the quality of your bone. Bone thickness is what is measured by X-ray type studies, the bone density studies. It's very important, and it probably represents about 75% of your bone strength. About 25% of your bone strength has to do with the quality, and we don't have any accurate tests of quality. Okay. So that when we get to patients who have low scores, we evaluate the patient. What's going on? Is there exercise deficient? Is there calcium deficient? Is there vitamin D deficient? I do a lot of studies in osteoporosis, and for instance, we're doing studies on people who have been on either Fosamax or Actonel for a really long period of time and trying to decide, is that the right medicine to keep them on or so forth. And when we do our studies, we have to do vitamin D levels on patients to see if they qualify. And I've been shocked at how many of my supposedly healthy patients don't qualify based on very low vitamin D levels.
Okay.
Also, Other aspects, you talked about exercise, and that's definitely an important component. There are more sophisticated analysis of whether or not the medicine is doing what you're supposed to be doing. So we think that bones, to be healthy, have to turn over. For instance, fluoride was a great treatment for osteoporosis, or thought to be, when the first research came out, because it made bones so thick. But it turned out those bones were quiet. They didn't turn over at all. And in fact, that led to quality problems that increased the fracture rate because they were what was called brittle. So it's a complicated formula. And we know that these different types of medicines that you're talking about work on bone health in different ways. And there are patients who need more than one medication, but it's really probably the exception to need to piggyback on that many medicines. And in terms of fracture prevention, people may be getting diminishing returns. Forteo itself has a recommendation. It's a synthetic PTH, a very new medicine, usually something prescribed by internists and endocrinologists. As an obstetrician-gynecologist, I don't really prescribe this medication, but it has a recommendation to not use it for more than 2 years.
2 years.
Fosamax and Actonel both have very, very long-term data.
Okay.
Actonel has, I believe it's at least 7 years. Fosamax has at least 10 years of data showing that continued improvement in terms of fracture prevention. Now, again, you can't look at that score. Some patients, their scores slightly improve. Some patients, their scores stay stable. In some cases, their scores decrease. Mm-hmm. But in all groups, when looked at in research settings, all groups have lower fracture incidence.
Okay.
So the score is not the whole story. And the score may or may not change with adding medication. Miacalcin is a synthetic calcitonin, another bone hormone. And there's good bone pain studies on it. There's good fracture prevention data from the hip, not such good data from the spine. And again, it's used in some patients, but not typically necessarily long-term as in multi-dose therapies. The other issue is a new warning label that's come out on some of the different longer, more powerful bisphosphonates. Both Actonel and Fosamax are bisphosphonates. And because you have to take them very frequently and they cause some side effects, particularly GI, stomach upset, heartburn in some patients, there are a number of bisphosphonates under testing that can be administered intravenously. And of patients who, the initial patients that got these intravenous types of bisphosphonates, many of them were quite sick. They had cancer or other serious medical conditions. But in that group, and in a few patients on the medicines of Fosamax and Actonel, there is a condition of osteonecrosis that's now been added by the FDA just very recently as a potential warning from long-term bisphosphonate use. And it has to do with a degeneration of your jawbone. And it's particularly a problem for people with very poor dental health. Mm-hmm. I've never seen a case other than pictures. And statistically, it's not common, but it's definitely a potential complication of very long-term bisphosphonate use. And experts really argue about whether you need to stay on a long time and whether or not you need breaks. There was a very good study done on Fosamax patients, and it showed that after you've been on Fosamax, taking 1 year off, the numbers really didn't change in terms of bone density. Now, 1 year of this group of patients isn't long enough for us to say whether or not you are increasing your fracture risk or not. So the experts are a little bit undecided on that, and I usually tell my patients individually that we have to evaluate you every year and decide, is this a year we're going to continue medicine, or is this a year we're going to take a medication holiday, a break, or switch medicines or add medicines. So it really has to be very individual.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope that helps.
That's very helpful. So you're saying probably an endocrinologist is somebody I should consult on.
Somebody or somebody that specializes in osteoporosis, and they may want to do blood testing. They may want to do urine testing. They may want to look at actual x-rays. The bone density tests, the new machines, mm-hmm. when interpreted by experts, sometimes can detect fractures, but most bone density tests are not designed to actually see fractures. To actually see fractures, you need actual x-rays mm-hmm. of your particularly your spine, particularly in cases of scoliosis where the bone density reading may be more difficult to interpret.
Yeah,
and when we do studies, they actually, to determine fractures or not, they actually do x-rays.
Well, thank you so much. That gives me a little bit of what to ask a doctor.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling in. Just as a reminder, we're talking this morning with Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She specializes in women's health here at the Women's Health Practice in Champaign-Urbana, and she is a professor of OBGYN at the University of Illinois College of Medicine. Closing in on the bottom of the hour, just about 27 after. You're listening to WILL Urbana. I'm not the normal host of Focus 580. David Inge is away today. My name is Todd Gleason. If you have questions for Dr. Truppen, please give us a call. The numbers are 1-800-222-9455 or locally 217-333-9455. 9455, of course, stands for WILL. Again, that's 800-222-9455 or 333 locally 9455. Let's continue just a bit with the osteoporosis.
Well, and I wanted to mention two categories. I'm glad you brought that up because I wanted to mention two categories of drugs that are commonly used to treat osteopenia, which is low bone, as well as osteoporosis, that didn't get into our list. And I thought, to be thorough, I should probably mention
sure.
them. Did you have a specific question
nope,
also?
No, go ahead.
And those two drugs are estrogen and SERM, selective estrogen receptor modulators, which are synthetic compounds made to act like estrogen on the bone. And these synthetic compounds actually have other potential actions in the body, many of which we can capitalize on and look at favorable aspects. And the one SERM that is approved for the prevention and treatment of osteoporosis is the drug raloxifene. And it's marketed by Eli Lilly under the brand name of Avista. It is not as ideal for the immediately perimenopausal or immediately postmenopausal patient because it can intensify hot flashes or bring back the menopausal vasomotor symptoms like hot flashes for 3 to 6 months. And so it's more commonly given in patients that are just beyond that time point. And in fact, it's also being studied as a possible breast cancer prevention, which is very interesting. And there was actually a recent news release that Pfizer has its new SERM. I do not know the generic name of it, but it's going to be called Oporia. And in studying this SERM, they have found that it actually helped reduce pain with intercourse. And as menopausal women get more estrogen deficient, they sometimes get some discomfort with intercourse. And interestingly, this SERM didn't aggravate that and actually helped treat it. So it's very intriguing because other SERMs have not done that.
We have a couple folks on the line, but I've got one quick question.
Sure.
I did have a couple quick questions. What do you advise patients about osteoporosis, your younger patients? And then when do you make the decision that somebody needs to be treated for osteoporosis?
Okay. Well, I think every person with the formal definition of osteoporosis needs some sort of treatment. Every patient who has a set of bones needs good bone health. They need a certain amount of calcium, vitamin D, and exercise to preserve their bone health. Every patient with risk factors for osteopenia, low bone mass, or risk factors for osteoporosis needs to be tested for those conditions. Then once you test, you can make a decision on treatment or not. And there are many patients who are osteopenic, they're not yet osteoporotic, or they're not yet at risk for fractures. And those patients, we need to have a discussion as to whether or not they just need increased calcium, vitamin D. Actually, it's interesting. Fosamax just released a product that's a Fosamax vitamin D combination. So you can get 7 days worth of your vitamin D at the same time you swallow your Fosamax pill, and they've priced it the same. So patients who are on Fosamax, I probably will be offering that switch. And so I think that, again, you talk to your physician about risk factors. What might risk factors be? Low trauma fractures, strong family history of osteoporosis, previous steroid use, smoking, very low bone mass, certain genetic backgrounds, menstrual irregularities, certain other kinds of medications, antihypertensives and thyroid medications have been associated with low bone mass. Women who have had a lot of stress, the sort of long-distance runners, people you might think are low in estrogen. So the osteoporosis at-risk group is the low estrogen group.
We do have a caller on the line from Martinton. We do have one on the cell phone as well. The caller from Martinton's on the toll-free line, so we'll catch the cell phone very quickly, and then we'll pick up Martinton. Thanks for calling in from the cell phone. We appreciate your call. What do you have for Dr. Troopin this morning?
Good morning, Dr. Troopin. Thank you. I was diagnosed with PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome, about 10 years ago when we were fighting infertility. And I don't have a lot of the symptoms that normally come with PCOS. I'm not overweight. I have very regular periods. But one problem I've always had is extra hair growth, extra facial hair growth. And since I'm blonde, it's very, very startling. I have a lot of dark hair growth on my chin. And this has really gotten to bother me over the course of the past several years. And I was wondering, will laser hair removal treatment be effective for this, or is there another treatment that I can look to?
Well, in the United States, we don't have the good medications they have in Europe that seem to work a little bit better. Hair follicle growth is very, very long. So the hair cycle can be 6 to 9 months. So even starting the medicines that we do have in the United States, it's hard to see any effective therapy take effect for a really long time. And they work better on preventing new hair growth and not so well on removing hair. Laser does remove hair, and it works very well, but it doesn't tend to be permanent, and the duration of the success tends to vary with the type of laser and the type of hair and what other treatments that you're doing, and that would be probably something that the person doing the laser after consultation could give you a little bit more information. Electrolysis can actually fairly effectively remove that hair. But again, anything to remove that specific hair may or may not treat the hair follicles in the area the way a medication can. We have the cream Vanquia that works a little bit. We have certain birth control pills that reduce your male hormone levels that work very well. And It's a problem for many patients, but we can do a pretty good job at getting it under control, but we don't do a great job on a permanent fix.
Okay, because I'm currently on Yasmin for birth control, but I have not seen, there has been no effect on the hair growth with that. I've been on that for 3 or 4 years now. And so basically my next step would be a dermatologist.
Probably dermatologists, some plastic surgeons do it, and many just hair places and spas do electrolysis, but you might want to talk to your health care provider about getting a prescription level of topical anesthetic because it's so uncomfortable. You might want to bring that with you, and my patients tell me it helps a lot. But in Europe, they have this pill called Diane 35 that I was always hoping that we would test in the United States and bring over, and I think some testing has been done. I haven't been involved in any of those trials, but it has a very good anti-androgen, spironolactone acetate, and it was a drug that when I was in college in the early 70s, I did some actual research projects on rats on sipropionate acetate, and here it is this many years later, and it's nothing that's made headway for us.
Okay. You don't happen to know if anybody in the area is participating in any trials?
I don't think there are.
Okay.
I don't think there are because I'm probably the only one that does these kinds of trials, but...
Okay. Okay, thank you for your time today. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. We do have a caller on line 4 from Martinton who's been waiting very patiently. Thanks much for waiting. We appreciate it. Your question for Dr. Troopin this morning is?
I would like a comment from you on TVT slangs.
Okay. for listeners, many individuals have what's called stress urinary incontinence. Now, some individuals also have other forms of incontinence, overactive bladder, where they have to urinate a lot, or urge discomfort, where they feel like they have to go even if they don't have to go. And sometimes those conditions can translate into some incontinence as well. But traditionally, stress incontinence is when you cough, jump, laugh, sneeze, and lose a little bit of urine. It is perfectly healthy for anyone with an extremely full bladder and a really funny stroke to lose a couple of drops of urine. And we usually put the cutoff of somebody who has so much incontinence that they are daily wearing pads. And even with minor amounts of strep, a quick little sneeze or a very little amounts of stress causing leaking to the point where they're either changing their clothes or wearing a pad. And these kinds of conditions need to be evaluated and potentially corrected. For most patients, there is no medical correction. I was involved in a research trial of a medication that actually both treats overactive bladder, and it did have some pretty good success on stress. It was one of those situations where it's a medicine designed for a completely different purpose, but when they were investigating it, it had some effect on stress. So there actually may be a medication out there before too long, and there have been some articles published on that, and I've actually tried it in a few patients already. There are these rubber devices called pessaries. Many young women have never heard of them, but they come in many different sizes and shapes. And they're essentially, you wear the pessary and it recreates the angle between the bladder and the urethra in the area of the bladder neck and repositions that bladder neck in within the pelvic sling such that when you cough and sneeze, the valve closes instead of opens. And that seems to work well, but it's something where you have to deal with it, be fitted, sometimes be refitted for a different shape or size, and wear it every day. So for young patients, surgical correction seems to be something that is reasonable. And the condition itself is like a hernia. So there are muscles that have separated, and the muscles are overlying structure that's stronger called fascia. And the fascia probably has either torn or completely ruptured. And the fixing of these conditions involves reapproximating the muscles and reapproximating the torn fascia and taking away excess vaginal covering, which is essentially skin-like. It's called mucosa. And because the tissue is defective, that repairing like that with your own defective tissues has a success rate, but not necessarily completely successful and not necessarily long-term successful, meaning it doesn't necessarily last more than a couple, 5 years. And even in the best cases, long-term success rates may only be 10 years, something like that. And so there's been a tremendous amount of interest in developing new techniques, and looks like probably performing some sort of sling, in other words, recreating that tissue, primarily the fascia type tissue, is probably the way most slings work. And original slings were done with pieces of tissue from the patient's own body, like pieces of fascia from other parts of her body. Then we tried pieces of fascia from essentially cadavers that have been treated and sterilized. And then they came up with the idea of using synthetic meshes. And these synthetic meshes are permanent, but we don't think they work by them physically being there, but by having a open meshwork kind of consistency, your own fibroblasts, the tissue that makes this fascia, grows in place. And so these sling procedures work by your own tissue growing in over the first week, the first couple of months, and even some improvement up to 6 months. And there are many of these slings out there. And the one that was developed first was this Ethicon product, the TVT. It's like calling all tissue Kleenex, but it's one brand, and there's five or six brands, and they have slightly different applicators and slightly different surgical techniques to their application, but they all have had very good data with them. Most of us who do these operations prefer one technique over the other. And there are some cost differences between the different slings that have led certain facilities to focus on certain devices versus the other. But the first decision is, what type of incontinence do you have? Second decision is there anything non-surgical that can be done to improve or the condition enough to either stall off surgery or prevent surgery altogether? And then lastly, if you're going to have surgery, do you have this type of procedure or one of the older type procedures that probably have longer track records? But most of us have gone to these slings for surgical correction of stress incontinence.
Could you give me a percentage of success?
Well, they have, I think TVT just came out with one 7-year study, but most of the studies are 2 years and 5 years, and they have, a lot depends on whether you're looking at what percent are 100% dry, what percent are dry enough to be happy and not wearing pads, and what percent are not very dry, and what percent got worse. Now, in these new sling operations, it's very uncommon to get worse. The sling operations that are new probably have a very small percent of what they call retention, meaning, well, it's so good, you have a little trouble starting to urinate. And sometimes you can work around that and get beyond that. But there's a very small percentage that do have those retention problems. But the vast majority of patients in the 85 to 95% range are at least fixed enough to be happy or completely fixed.
Okay, but it's just a temporary thing and that it...
Well, with these TVTs, as I said, we have 5 and 7 year data, but we do not have 10, 20, 30 year data. Mm-hmm. So nobody can tell you what's going to happen in 10, 20 years. And
have the 7-year test been satisfactory?
Yes.
Okay.
And we think that statistically these slings are way outperforming some of the traditional operations. So if it's outperforming at 2 and 5 years, for instance, shouldn't it outperform at 10 and 20 years? It should.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
A lot depends on you and your overall health. And we can do a lot to not make our bladders behave very well. So lots of caffeine intake, too much fluid intake, lots of being overweight so that weight may be, gravity may be a component, smoking, I don't know if I mentioned that yet. These kinds of things do not make it easy. And even if you have the operation in conditions that are so suboptimal may be less likely to be successful.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you, caller. Is it an inherited condition? Does it come down from one side or the other, from
it tends
the male
to
or female?
Run, it tends to run in families, but it's primarily related to if you've had children and how you've had that child. For instance, it's very much less common in people who've had cesarean births than in vaginal deliveries. And there are some individuals that are electively selecting to have a cesarean birth just to avoid bladder problems in the future. Very few obstetrician gynecologists really endorse that position. We feel that there's too many other pros and cons to consider rather than that one factor.
We've just about 15 minutes left to discuss OBGYN and women's health issues with Dr. Troopman this morning. If you have a question, please give us a call at 1-800-222-9455 or locally 217-333-9455. It's our monthly look at women's health. Thank you very much again, Dr. Troopman, for joining us today. It has passed very quickly. If you have questions, give us a call. Once again, those numbers are 800-222-9455 or 217-333-9455. It just doesn't matter. As soon as I give the numbers out, you're full. I have questions,
okay.
But we'll go on to the phone lines. Line number one is with us this morning, I believe. Is that right, Henry? Ready to go? Looks like it. Henry tells me that Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning, tells me line one is there and available. Good morning to you. You have a question for Dr. Troopman?
I do have a question. Good morning. I am calling on my sister's behalf, hopefully I can give enough symptoms and get some sense of what might be happening for her. She has been having this really constant pressure in the urethra area as though she needs to go to the bathroom basically 24 hours a day. Even when she goes and empties her bladder, the pressure is still there. she can cough, sneeze, any of those things, and she's fine in terms of, I think, the muscle strength is there. But she's trying to find out what's going on, but it's kind of eluding her.
Well, there are a number of conditions, and it may be something simple like urge incontinence or overactive bladder. And there are a couple of quick tests that a healthcare provider could do to try to answer that. And there are a number of medications that do treat that. In fact, three new medications have been released on the market specifically for this feeling. And the medicines are very effective in terms of correcting the sensation, but they tend to have side effects. And some patients can't stay on them long enough. We usually recommend a course of 3 to 6 months of therapy with these medicines, so it's not a quick fix either. There also is a condition called interstitial cystitis, which is actually a condition of the bladder wall rather than the urethra, but it can manifest as pressure symptoms of the urethra.
So far, you're ruling interstitial
cystitis out.
But I guess maybe I don't know if they're going to do testing again in, you know, a month or so, but
it sounds like she needs a set of tests called urodynamics, as well as either a gynecologist or a urogynecologist exam, and try to get a firm diagnosis. And then once you get a diagnosis, you can hone in a little bit better on the treatment.
Okay. And what is the series of tests called?
Urodynamics.
Euro, yes. Okay. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So that was the caller on line one, and we do have a caller on line two from Champaign with us. Do you have a question for Dr. Troopin this morning?
Yes, hello.
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 Yes.
Could you please talk about fibrocystic disease, explain what it is, and also discuss some treatment possibilities? I will listen off the air. Thanks very much.
Thanks for calling in.
Well, fibrocystic breast condition is one of those. We used to call it fibrocystic breast disease, and we flipped to calling it fibrocystic breast condition because it's so common. And in some studies, if you use fairly liberal criteria, 7 out of 10 women will have some of these changes. And essentially what it is that the glands of the breast become a little bit thicker, and the terminal ducts, or the place where actually milk would be made if you're making milk, can get fluid trapped within there because the fluid usually escapes through the pipe, so the pipe wall gets so thick that not all the fluid can escape. And so women can get areas of tenderness, areas of minute little cysts, or sometimes bigger cysts, and areas of what we call thickness, so that fibrous change to their breast, and it can be uncomfortable. In mild forms, you don't need to be treated whatsoever. In slightly more significant cases, sometimes birth control pills will help. The severe cases have been somewhat refractory to treatment. If you have a specific lump that becomes very large and tender, it could be drained, or when necessary, it can be removed. And we like to be sure that as much as we can, that area is not cancerous lump. So that presents a little bit of a problem. There have been a number, I've been involved in a trial once, there have been a number of proposed treatments, and not a lot of treatments have been very successful. Danocrine, which is a treatment for endometriosis, has recently been talked about as having some success. Tamoxifen, which is a medication used to prevent breast cancer in older women, has also, which is actually a CIRM, we talked about the CIRMs with osteoporosis. Tamoxifen is actually technically in that chemistry category, and it's also had some effectiveness. And vitamin E has enjoyed a lot of support in some clinical trials for at least effectiveness on the pain and discomfort. But effective treatment for severe fibrocystic breast condition has eluded us to some extent.
And we have a call on line three with us this morning as well. Good morning to you. Thanks for waiting. You have a question for Dr. Troopin.
Yes. I'm sorry I tuned in late today. I've heard you in the past talk about we need estrogen, vitamin D, and calcium to deal with osteoporosis prevention, and I'm curious about soy products and how much estrogen or estrogen type might be provided by that.
Many plants have what's called phytoestrogens, and soy happened to have a fairly high density of these plant-type estrogens, as does flaxseed and clover and black cohosh. And there's been a lot of interest in utilizing these estrogens for a variety of conditions. We've looked at it in terms of treatment of menopausal symptoms. We've looked at it in terms of preservation of bone health. It's been looked at in terms of preservation of lipid levels, so keeping the good cholesterol good and the bad cholesterol low. And unfortunately, these phytoestrogens are so weak in comparison to the synthetic estrogens and other estrogens marketed for some of the same conditions that most studies have not been very supportive that intake of soy can really effectively avoid other treatments. It's also been thought that soy may act differently in premenopausal and postmenopausal women, and this is a brand new concept. And the idea is that when you're, before menopause, when you have a lot of estrogen around and that estrogen binds up to all the receptors, maybe soy even acts anti-estrogen because it's this weak estrogen that's now going to try to bump some potent estrogen around. But then when you get into menopause and there's not this potent estrogen around and all the receptors are there, not as many receptors are really there because some of them do go away in menopause. Now maybe when soy is available in our system, maybe it's going to act more positive, and that maybe we haven't really studied the right timing and the right dose. But to make a long story short, there are no actual studies that support soy use exclusively for treatment or prevention of osteopenia or osteoporosis.
I appreciate that.
Thank you very much, calling in. If you have a question, we have just a few minutes left. You can call in now at 800-222-9455 or 217-333-9455 with your question for Dr. Suzanne Truppen. There were a couple of items that you wanted to get to yet this morning, and it's gone very quickly.
I wanted to tie back in with some of these compounds that we're talking about, the SERMs and the estrogen and some of the other osteopenia and osteoporosis treatments. One problem that we have, of course, is a very high rate of breast cancer in the United States. And somewhere between 1 in 7 and 1 in 8 American women are going to get breast cancer at some time in their life. Now, most American women will not die of their breast cancer. 95% of individuals who get breast cancer will not die of it. At any rate, still, we're looking very carefully at what we can do to lower this number and improve things. And we do use mammography as our standard for identifying an existing cancer. And when a mammogram is interpreted as dense, this is two problems. Number one, it's harder to see an existing cancer should it be there. And secondly, breast density itself seems to be an independent risk factor for breast cancer. So if you are told that you have dense breasts on your mammogram, it is a slightly greater risk factor. And interestingly, the SERMs do not increase breast density. That was something shown by the recent Women's Health Initiative trial. And estrogen itself doesn't increase density like the estrogen progesterone combination. So one more thing to discuss with your healthcare provider when picking an osteoporosis treatment is to consider breast health in the mix of issues that you need to discuss.
One more call to round up the hour. This one from Urbana. Good morning to you. Thanks for calling in. We appreciate it.
Good morning. You might have touched on this. I just tuned in, so I apologize if you've already talked about it. I was wondering if you could talk about some of the advantages to women's health if they breastfeed their children. I had heard recently that it helps to prevent rheumatoid arthritis and also breast cancer. I was wondering if there are any other benefits to women's health. Thank you.
Well, one of the best benefits specifically to mom, and obviously there's benefits to the baby, but you use up calories. So that's important, and it helps normalize your weight. And it's not certain whether it's going to have other benefits, such as your cholesterol levels and so forth. But as your weight goes down, typically cholesterol levels do normalize. The whole whether or not it helps prevent breast cancer piece has that one. The studies have been all over the map, but our general feeling is yes, lactation does decrease your risk of breast cancer. We think that it has important effects between bonding between the mom and the baby, and that is important for mom as well as baby. In terms of bone health, you do lose a little bit of bone density each year you lactate, but then when you go off, that bone comes back. It's a natural physiologic response to come back, unless at that point you're doing something else to offset your bone health. So it is very important for lactating females to get their exercise and vitamin D and calcium, or that could be a negative. I'm not aware of the data about rheumatoid arthritis. It's interesting. I'll have to look it up, especially if it was new. It might be a report I missed. And we don't know in terms of certain other health, overall health benefits to the mom. Some of the studies have been a little mixed because in the United States we had a little dip in our statistical breastfeeding rates. Some of our data on our population is lacking, and some of the data is in third world countries where they have other nutritional issues. So we need actually a little bit more data, and we have target rates of breastfeeding that are starting to be met in parts of the United States, so that's very exciting.
Dr. Troopen, the time has ended. Thank you so very much for joining us. Any final word before we let you go for the morning?
Well, we have lots of exciting things. I was going to talk a little bit also about endometriosis, and there are a lot of new compounds around to treat the pain of endometriosis and potentially have a benefit for fertility. We didn't get back to our fertility discussion, but maybe next month.
Maybe next month. Thank you very much for joining us. You made my job extraordinarily easy, along with the callers, at least this morning in the first set of Focus 580 I've hosted. My guess is that the next three won't be nearly as easy on me. We do appreciate you being with us this morning. Dr. Suzanne Troopen is with the Women's Health Practice. She's an OBGYN there, and she's a clinical professor of OBGYN at the College of Medicine here at the University of Illinois.